Well, welcome to Firefighter Behavioral Health with Dr. Beth Murphy on this lovely Friday afternoon. I'm John Murphy, her dashboard operator today. And today we're going to be talking about an interesting topic for me as a healthcare provider, putting my other hat on as a physician's assistant. We're going to talk about independent medical exams for psychological issues affecting firefighters in the fire service. But the first thing I want to say is that if you're living in the West, Western United States, you know that we're on fire. And so we want to think about all of the firefighters out there in Oregon and California, Washington State, Montana, the Western states, keep all of those firefighters in your thoughts and prayers. It's a dangerous, dangerous operation out there. And I know because I've lost a friend of mine in Arizona about 3 weeks ago, Jeff. Who passed away in a plane crash and while he was doing an air tac operation, and he sorely missed not only in the industry but certainly in his other activities that he has done in the fire service. And certainly for his family. So thoughts and prayers for Jeff and Jeff Pachura, I'm sorry. And that we're also getting ready in 2 weeks to go to Indianapolis for those of you who are going to join the speakers at FDIC Indianapolis August, for me, it's 2nd to the 5th, but for the rest of you, it's probably the 1st or the 7th, where they have HOT, the hot hands-on training classes. Women in fire will be there. And hundreds, if not thousands, of firefighters from around the country and around the world, actually, will be there to share their particular experiences with all of you. Certainly, a lot of learning takes place at nighttime. In the various restaurants and taverns, and I encourage everyone to take advantage of those particular educational sessions that occur after 5:30 at night. So while we get Dr. Murphy all loaded up here on our dashboard, we're going to be talking about independent medical exams. And so from my perspective as a healthcare provider, I deal a lot with worker compensation claims in an occupational health setting, and certainly a number of those who come into the clinics that I staff are firefighters. And so occupational injuries, as most of you are aware, occur on the job, from the simple lacerations to the the critical fractures and head injuries and penetrating wounds and burns and those sorts of things. And so your occupational health provider with a team of therapists and other specialists will help to, chart a pathway so you can return to work, at 100%. And hopefully that occurs after intensive physical therapy or medication or specialty referrals such as orthopedists or neurologists or hand surgeons. I send a lot of our firefighters to see a hand surgeon to get firefighters back into shape. But there is a point in time where therapy basically runs its course. So for physical therapy or for all the surgical interventions have worked their magic. And now we need to send somebody to an independent medical evaluation, or IME. So for the medical side, the healthcare provider, which in, our case may be Washington State Labor and Industries, it may be a third-party administrator called Sedgwick or Corvell, and there's two or three of them, and I'm not sure, all of them across the country, but those are big providers, and so they essentially manage the healthcare, administer healthcare benefits for your employees. So An independent medical exam is that they find some physician who's a specialist in a particular area that what they would do is to evaluate the firefighter or the individual's ability to return to work, with maybe some accommodations or with some limitations, or they may declare the person to be, 100% disabled, and then a disability rating is applied to those particular firefighters, which is not anything we're going to be talking about this evening, but it's just the process of an independent medical exam. Reading hundreds of them from the individuals I have sent to independent medical evaluators, I have to tell you that it's kind of the grab bag of expertise where I've had firefighters come back and they say, well, he just looked at my record, he never touched me. And so, how could he evaluate? And I don't agree with what, the rating is that this IME physician provided. And certainly you have an opportunity to get a second opinion and those sorts of things. Again, that's all process and procedure. But I think what we're going to have Dr. Murphy talk about is a little bit different from the psychological aspect is those are the ones that you can't see. I mean, those are the psychological injuries that are what I would classify as hidden. And it's only through, research and study and evaluation and tests and those sorts of things that individuals of Dr. Murphy's caliber do, as opposed to physical disabilities, fractured legs, missing limbs, those sorts of things are more tangible. The psychological is less tangible, but certainly very important. So I think that being that I see Dr. Murphy on the phone and on my dashboard, I'm assuming that she is all ready to rock and roll on this topic of IME.
Well, yeah, to a point. So I don't know if you – oh, hello, everybody. Dr. Murphy here. So as you all know, if you've ever listened to me before, I take a lot of inspiration for my talks based on kind of what's going on. Sometimes it's, what's impacting my life, and sometimes it's, first responders that I am interacting with. And so, or I'm posed with a question about something, and not necessarily that I'm the one that's engaged in it. But, and I don't know if John had said it. I know he told you that we were going to talk about fit for duty. Did you say that?
I think I did. If I didn't say it, okay. Let's talk about fit for duty and independent medical exams.
Okay. Yeah, I heard you say a lot about independent medical exams, but basically this came out of a discussion that I was having with him earlier. And, some of it was about questions that I had when I've done fit for duties or if I'm considering to do one. And some of it was just kind of like hypothetical because I just was like interested and I wasn't quite sure. So he's got the legal expertise and I have the psychological expertise. So I don't know if you can just take a moment to imagine it, but imagine the conversations that we have. So this is kind of going to be a peek into what we talk about. So I was talking to John about fit for duties. So I think fit for duties are important. I have done them in the past, and I've done some where the person that I was doing the assessment on and the department were kind of on the same page. They're like, okay, this is somebody that we know has, for whatever reason, been impacted in such a way that it's impacted their performance, and they've taken time off and they've gone to, you know, have whatever treatment was necessary, and now they want to come back, and we want them back, and this is part of our process, because it's something that is actually of benefit to the individual as well, and obviously to the department. But I've also been presented with fit for duties where it was punitive, really, and that's kind of the thing that really bugs me is when fit for duty is presented as punitive, and that's sometimes it's not what's intended, but it's the way it's presented. But and that just means that there needs to be some education around it. So you know, we're having this discussion. So psychological services within the fire service, or with the fire service, or somewhere associated with the fire service, I think is necessary, and it speaks to what I have talked about before in trying to take, I want to take a more positive approach to all this. And so the fit for duties are a great tool for that, because it protects the individual and it protects the department. But there are a lot of questions around it. And so we're going to talk about some of those questions that I had asked earlier, and I'm going to try and think of a couple other ones, because I usually remember what's in front of me, and then I'm like, I know I had more questions. So my question, and I don't think that this is going to be in any particular order, so I think that this is going to probably jump around as far as the process. And so my question to John was, for the first one that jumped in my mind was questions around accessing the employees' records. So when someone is sent for a fit for duty, then you know, the question is, and it should always be, you know, does this person have any disciplinary issues? Are they do they have a history of being a good performer, and that type of thing? So it's useful. I mean, it's not always necessary, but in order to get the big picture, it's useful to know what this person was like before the fit for duty. And so that would be one aspect. And then the other aspect, it's also important with the fit for duty to establish medical care or treatment. And so that actually was where the question was how can, because in discussing it with HR or the HR representative or whoever the contact person is, it's like they can provide records to you. But I had heard the comment of I can't give you the medical records though. And so that was my question to John is, if you're being requested to do this fit for duty and they can turn over some of the records, why can't they turn over all of the records? So basically, John, the question is, how would a fit for duty expert get the medical records concerning the employee from their employer? And is it necessary, do you think?
Well, that's a good question. So just in the personnel files, the department should keep two sets of personnel files, actually two sets of files on an employee. The first set is your personnel records, which is, you know, the hiring application, the testing, you know, salaries, any sort of discipline, any sort of letters of accommodation, and those sorts of things that are kind of running on a day-to-day basis, or the generic and important stuff that goes on in a firefighter's life for the 25 or 30 years that he or she may be a member of the organization. The second file should be a medical file. The medical file is kept separate from the personnel file because you want to have that sort of wall between the information, and especially if there's a request for records from the outside, either from the media or from an investigator or, you know, any of those sorts of things. So medical information is not accidentally or erroneously disclosed. There is a method to get that particular information, is that all of our medical information that's in possession of our employer is HIPAA protected. And HIPAA, you know, we've talked about that before. It's HIPAA is basically an insurance portability act that sort of allows your insurance cover to travel with you from employer to employer. But there's a section in there which, you know, kind of set the fire service on its ear about protecting health information, which in actuality most states had protections already in place, that those particular health files are not privy to, you know, public disclosure. So HIPAA sort of tightened that little loophole in there that, you know, either accidentally or intentionally, that medical information was released to whoever the requester was. Today, the information, the healthcare information especially, can be obtained through a release signed by a patient. So for an example, if Dr. Murphy was doing fit for duty on an employee, a firefighter employee, and there was a determination that, well, maybe the employee had been in certain treatment facilities or had gone on to see certain medical providers for either medical or psychological events. I think the determination, and maybe with the client, is this information important to our sort of discussion about fit for duty, or, you know, is there a certain level of disclosure that, you know, the client will disclose to the provider that, yes, I've attended this session, yes, I'm on this medication, these are the doctors I'm seeing, and sort of give a complete picture of what is going on. One of the things that Dr. Murphy and I talked about today was the sort of honest disclosure of information. And so, like, when you do any sort of fit for duty or even an internal investigation, you need to determine the honesty and the credibility of whoever your client is. And so if there's this sort of, I'm not really sure that they're telling me the whole truth, maybe it would be better to take a look at what records you do have, not only in your medical file that the department has, but any and all of your medical providers. Your client, Dr. Murphy, has to sign a medical release in order to get that information. And mm-hmm. employers and physicians' offices and hospitals and those entities and agencies, you know, have a duty under the law to protect that information.
Okay. So, I think then I had, like, followed up in our discussion, like, you know, do I even really need it? And I think that this is an important question, which I don't think is often addressed. I mean, I know people who do fit for duties and, you know, it's like they, they'll try and access everything they can access. But, you know, when I think about it, I'm, because they're thinking about it in terms of, like, establishing, now I'm trying to think of it, like, you know, it's getting a, you know, they want to get kind of a big picture of the individual, and they want to know how did this person perform and when did it change? And, but they're thinking only in the context of doing this assessment. And I think that that's kind of like one of the things that might feed into why first responders, firefighters are so suspicious of psychological testing and why it might feel punitive. Because I think that a lot of the professionals doing these evaluations and not being intimately familiar with the fire service, they're looking at, well, I want to get the big picture, but not so much about, I want to understand why this person got to the point where they needed a fit for duty, and how can this fit for duty help them? I mean, because honestly, it's like the fit for duties are requested by the department, and the department is paying for it, and so then the department is the client. So the individual that is getting the evaluation is not the client. So so someone doing a fit for duty is basically addressing the need of the department, which honestly can, as I say that out loud, I'm like going, well, no wonder nobody likes fit for duty. So, but I think maybe where I get hung up and why I've had a lot of questions around this for John is that I look at this person is really struggling, and they're struggling enough that they had to be off work for a period of time, whether they were getting treatment or not. And hopefully if somebody is off work and it's related to mental health, they are doing something to take care of it. That's always my hope. And so I look at it as I want information about their, how they were, you know, like what kind of employee were they? And did it change? And then I asked the question, well, why did it change? I'm of a mind that if you have a good employee and they're doing well, they're doing their job and they're, you know, they're in it and they're loving it, it's like when you see a change and they are negatively impacted and now they've gone from a high performer to, you know, not coming to work, my mindset goes to what happened. And I'm thinking something happened and now they're struggling with PTSD or depression or anxiety, or, I mean, and maybe it's just an adjustment disorder and there's like some big issues going on in their life, you know, like a divorce or a sick child or cancer or whatever it is. And so I look at it from like, what's going on with this person and how can we help them? And so this is why fit for duty evaluations can be really difficult for me, because I, you know, I understand the psychology, but I came from the fire service and I want to change how psychology is viewed in the department. And I want it to be used for good, basically. And so when I want that medical information and their personnel file, I'm looking for what changed and can we, you know, and then when I make my recommendations, whether it's that they're unfit or they're conditionally fit or they're fit, I mean, well, if they're fit, then there's no issue. But if it's anything less than that, I want to know how to help them. And so I want my recommendations not to just be like kind of a pencil whip format where, you know, people write recommendations that, you know, people typically write. It's like something that is meaningful. And so for me, having the whole picture, including the medical records, is about identifying if this person has had a significant change and are they, are they at risk of losing their job because of their, that kind of accumulation of stress, you know, whether it's PTSD or not. You know, it's like you can have the accumulation of stress, have it impact your performance and not have it be PTSD. So it doesn't always work that way. And we're not really great at dealing with, well, mental health things in general. But it's like we're coming around to where, okay, we can deal with PTSD. But anything else, that still throws people for a loop. So I go back and forth on, like, well, is it really necessary to have everything from, you know, their medical records to their personnel records? But for me, it is. And it is important for me because I want to use it for good. I want to help people by making a recommendation that is going to be useful for them. And so that kind of led to the other thing, or one of the other things that John and I talked about, and that was if I have somebody that is unfit for duty because of psychological issues now, and my recommendation is, and my recommendation will always be therapy. It will always involve that. But can I recommend that they go to light duty and do therapy? Can I recommend that they do light duty, you know, 20 hours a week and therapy? And then what does that do legally? Like, what does that do for the department? And is it actually helpful to the individual? And John had said, well, you're just kind of passing the buck. And I'm like, well, I could see that. But it's like, I don't really want to be responsible for somebody losing a job. So John, what was it that you had said about that?
Well, just to be honest, you're stuck between a rock and a hard spot when you need to make the determinations. But I think what we talked about is looking at the objectiveness of the testing to determine if the individual is actually fit for duty, and that the fire departments hire firefighters to be firefighters. They don't hire individuals to come into the department to go on light duty and be on perpetual light duty, which by law, the department does not, if you've never had a light duty position before, you're really not compelled to create a light duty position. When people are kind of surprised when they hear that, is that only because, you know, there's a light duty, you know, we've heard of light duty is, you know, a benefit, I think, to the department and the individual, you know, for recovery to come back to work. Departments aren't compelled to create light duty positions if you've never had one. And the corollary to that is if you've had a light duty position, then you need to afford that light duty position to pretty much anyone in the organization that qualifies for that. But, you know, sometimes, and I know that, you know, the fire service sometimes to a fault wants to retain the services of an individual because it's their livelihood. They'll move them into a light duty position, or they'll move them into other divisions if there's other divisions to be moved into. you know, to do the nice thing as the employer, to be the nice guy and help this person retain their job. The reality is you're just pushing the problem around in your department, and then everyone suffers from the loss of performance or the lack of performance or those things that has been brought on by an individual that may not either be physically or psychologically qualified to be assigned to those particular tasks or duty. And light duty is, if you do have light duty, it's a short-term bridge between, you know, injury and recovery. And so, you know, how long should light duty, you know, be in existence? And some of it has to do with policy. In my experience, sometimes the insurance, your department insurance carrier is the driver as to what light duty duration would be. I remember early on that when we had an individual that was assigned to light duty and we didn't have any light duty for them, they went home, you know, for the duration of their light duty assignment. And so, you know, the firefighters are saying, well, Jesus, you know, this is like a vacation, I'm getting paid for it. The department's like, oh my gosh, you know, we're paying a lot of money into these sort of programs and we're not getting any benefit out of it. And the insurance company says, well, we're tired of paying for these particular programs. And so if you're going to have a light duty position in an organization, then the person needs to show up and be productive. And then and that's going to be for a finite time until they get, you know, either a fit for duty or the individuals then declared to be, you know, what we term in the medical side, and my medical hat is maximum medical improvement, and then the person, you know, goes back to work. Sometimes they can't. So I think the fit for duty or the independent medical exam that I talked about earlier would determine if that firefighter is capable or able to go back to work in 100% capacity. And sometimes they're not, and they needed to be placed on, you know, to get a disability rating. And then they're on disability and not working. So it's a tough position for, you know, Dr. Murphy and her counterparts and even the medical community to be in. And as I said earlier, the physical injury is easy to see, relatively speaking. The psychological injury takes a lot more research and testing to determine whether they're fit for duty.
Yeah, so then after I, like, asked the question, I was listening to you, it reminded me again, and this is something that I have to tell myself, because it's not actually me making the decision as to whether that person maintains their employment. I mean, I am only providing opinion based on, you know, assessment, so tests, validated tests, and then yes, it does incorporate my my impression, you know, so how the person presents to me, and so there is some subjectivity in there a little bit. some people would say there's a lot there. But it's not my decision. So, like, my evaluation, like, I don't come back and say, okay, this person should not be able to work anymore. But my, you know, I recognize that by doing the evaluation and saying that they are not fit to carry out the duties of, it may seem like that. But it is up to the employer. And I'm not sure, I don't know if this has ever been the case, but John, do you know of anybody who where they were deemed not fit, where the department ignored that and you know, had them come back to work anyway? Because that person wanted to?
Well, there's always the human factor, right? I know that in my own experience, we've had injured firefighters that have gone out Say for an example on shoulder injuries, you know, the physical injury. I don't think we've ever had a psychological event that we brought people back either early or if at all. But the physical aspect is we had a shoulder injury, firefighter tore a rotator cuff, had surgery, was in therapy, wanted to come back. We sent him for a fit for duty from an orthopedist, and the orthopedist said, well, he's not really ready to come back. He's about 3 weeks out. And then we want to see him again. And so the chief at the time says, no, we're going to bring him back to work because, interestingly enough, they didn't want to pay overtime. So they bring the firefighter back to work. That shift, they had a working alarm, and he re-injures his shoulder again, and now he's out for 12 weeks and not 6 weeks. And so we compounded. We made a huge mistake, which we never replicated. But I think that, you know, coming back early at the behest of, you know, the firefighter wants to come back or the fire chief doesn't want to pay overtime is not a very good management tool.
So I was thinking of, like, I know that there have been cases, like, with pre-hire psych evals where generally for that one, it's low risk, medium risk, high risk, and that there have been firefighters that are, like, future potential firefighters had received this high risk, and the department ignored it and hired them anyway. I know cases where that's happened. I don't think usually when somebody is sent for a fit for duty on a psychological basis, they're more likely to accept the unfit and determine that that person needs to be let go. And like I said, it's because a lot of times those fit for duties end up being something punitive rather than supportive, or it's the opposite of punitive.
Non-punitive, therapeutic.
Okay. I was thinking like therapeutic, which is kind of like where I come from. You know, I think that the assessments are great tools to help see where there are some deficits and strengths, you know. So it's like what work still needs to be done, basically. But it's like that's not really what you get hired to do when you're hired to do a fit for duty. The other thing, so it's a hard place to be in. I mean, so it's like when John said, where you're just kind of passing the buck. You know, the fact is that I'm not the person making the decision, but it feels like it if I say unfit. And if it's unfit, then there's a determination there of unfit or unfit due to psychological reasons. And so that means that there is a kind of a diagnostic component to that evaluation. And so one of the things that is pretty consistent with firefighters is they like to minimize or ignore their symptoms, which is pretty much why they get in trouble. So trying to fake out the test is not the best thing to do. And I've seen that happen. Now, some of the tests that we use have what's called validity measures in them. And that will identify if a person is trying to fit or trying to do like a, like manage the impression. So it might be like a positive image management. So that means that they're not doing things that the average person would endorse. And it's not about one question, right? This is about a pattern of answering. So, and there are a couple different measures that might look at this, and they're generally more of the longer personality measures, and you all probably are familiar with it because you're probably taking it, but one of them is the MMPI-2, and there's actually MMPI-3 out now, and then there's a revised format, and they do have some validation for like first responder population. So it's not like you're getting compared to like the general public. And that would be the same for like the other one is the PAI, and that's personality assessment inventory, which is a little bit shorter and the questions are more straightforward. And then there's a California personality assessment. I think there's one more, but the MMPI-2 and the PAI are the ones that I use. And honestly, it's like the one that in Washington State, that would be the one that most people would use. So, but it's important to do it and to put it into context. So, and it's hard to put things in context when you don't really understand the big picture. And if you don't understand the environment the environment and it beyond just getting that description of the job description. So it goes beyond that. So it's like whoever does these assessments should be culturally competent. And it's a funny thing to think about culture and the fire service having its own culture, but it does. So it's important to be aware of what that culture is. And one of the things that is really common is that unwillingness to admit to a weakness, and mental health is seen as a weakness. And so when a firefighter or a future firefighter, when they answer things in a way that they think is going to them look stronger, or if they're not admitting to things because it's going to make them look weaker, then they're not really helping their case. So, and then when they're vague, they don't provide enough information in order to apply context to the assessment. So it's important to be open and answer the questions honestly. And then also, and I'm going to say this, and some psychologists who I'm sure is not listening to this, they might cringe, but you don't want to give too much information, because this is the other thing, and I've run into this with other psychologists, is that it is not necessary to put everything in the report. The report, you put enough information in there to answer whatever the question is, and it means that you don't have to say exactly what they said or everything that they said. And this is actually something that I am noticing also with doing diagnostic evaluations for labor and industry, is that sometimes people are writing too much information. And then that information goes back to the department, and the department doesn't need to know some of that stuff because it's not, the specifics are not really relevant, but the psychological factor behind it I mean, that's what's important. And so with a fit for duty, you have to be aware of that as well. So it'd be inadvertently painting a picture that will like fuel the fire, if you will. So if a chief is wanting to just get rid of the problem, then there are certain things that you could write down that could like create a greater bias against the employee, and then that, you know, then it is basically you've contributed to that person being fired. So it's important to understand the context and to be careful about what you report. And in the context of like doing fit for duty or like in working with labor and industry and doing evaluations there, because that could be used against them. And everybody has this idea about what the fire service is and what kind of people should be there. And it's not always like a balanced, accurate picture. And there most definitely is a stigma against mental health. So, I don't blame some people for being wary of psychologists, because I know that their mental health has been used against them. So when I do a fit for duty, I want to be conscientious, and I don't know for good or bad. It's like, because I know all these things, I think sometimes it can really bog me down, because I know how it can be used because I was in that environment. So it makes me want to advocate for the employee, but basically I'm hired by the employer. So it kind of puts me in a awkward position, just because I do have that knowledge. And so it's kind of hard to step outside of that. And I know there were some other questions I had, John, today when I was asking about it. I wanted to know more about like light duty. I know the other question was, it's like if they make their recommendation, like let's say that this person is unfit because of psychological reasons, and the recommendation is made for therapy and light duty, or light duty should be considered. If you do start that person with light duty and they're not performing well, then what does that do for the department? Like, does that tie their hands a little bit?
Well, not necessarily. I think one of the things that departments need to understand is that, you know, light duty is the exception to the department's function. And so there are job descriptions and job analysis that determine what the firefighter, the fire marshal, all of the different disciplines within the fire service do. So you can measure performance based on whatever the job analysis and the job performance standards are. Light duty is sort of this redheaded stepchild of, you know, and if you do it again, I would term it as a necessary, and I put it into quotation marks, evil, that again, you're trying to salvage the firefighter to continue on in his career or her career and provide a bridge between, you know, injury and recovery. And so if you're going to provide the bridge between injury and recovery, then I think there needs to be some sort of a job analysis of exactly what light duty looks like. You know, what is their function? So for an example, when I do return somebody for a light duty position from a physical injury, it's like, you know, what are their capacities, capabilities, and limitations? So, you know, for a firefighter who may have a back injury, as an example, so we sort of restrict the lifting capacity. We restrict the pushing and pulling, the, you know, no climbing ladders, limited stairs, you know, can't climb into a fire engine, you know, and it's very specific as to what the firefighter does. But, you know, can they do administrative duties? Can they type on a typewriter? Oh, my God, I'm dating myself. On a computer, can they answer the phone? Can they, you know, staff the front desk? Can they file? You know, can they, you know, do those sorts of things? I think that, you know, provides context to whatever the position is, and it provides a productive environment for the department and for the firefighter to come back, you know, soon to full duty. So I guess your question is that the person who is on light duty is non-performing. So what you would also want to put in there is that, you know, say an 8-hour workday, because most firefighters would be reassigned to a 40-hour work week, is that, you know, 4 of the 8 hours per day would be in the light duty administrative position. And 4 hours of that day may be in a rehabilitative facility, like a physical therapist or massage therapist or strength training or core, you know, those sorts of things with an agency or an organization that's, you know, takes the firefighter away from the firehouse. For the psychological part, that may be counseling. That may be alcohol and drug rehabilitation. That may be all the things that would lead up to a psychological issue. And I think the department needs to clearly identify what those limitations and capacities are. So, for an example, if the firefighter fails to attend rehabilitation sessions, the department gets a report back of, you know, did the firefighter show up or not? And so we get a weekly, you know, they were here from 12 to 4 or 1 to 5 or whatever it is. Do we need to know, you know, what the capacity is at the time? No, we don't. We'll get that at the end. For the psychological aspects, it's the same thing. Did the firefighter show up to sessions, you know, to therapy? Did, you know, those sorts of things? And did they participate? And that's a very simple, non-HIPAA, offending way to figure out whether the person is actually attending these particular sessions. Now, whether the therapy is successful or not, you know, you, Dr. Murphy, or your counterpart may get that information from, if you're continuing in the care, of course, you may get that information from the therapist and say, you know, Firefighter Murphy, and I'll use myself as an example, you know, showed up, you know, 8 out of 10 times. And so where was the other 2 times? That's a question the employer would want to know. And, you know, participated in, you know, this therapy, that therapy that we prescribed for him or her that, you know, was successful. So there seems to be, you know, making successive gains in the therapy session. That's stuff that you would get, not necessarily the employer, because as you said earlier, sometimes employers, the rumor mill is horrible. We can't keep a secret. And so the less they know, the better off I think the employee is and the employer is as well.
Yeah, you're talking about like the information that might get back to the employer.
Yeah, less is more. So you don't want just did they show up or not? Did they participate or not?
Right.
And then if, you know, if you get in a report that, you know, the guy didn't show up, you know, for 5 days in a row, or he just sits there and looks at his phone, or then he's not participating in session.
Yeah. Well, and like speaking of like information and what's not good to get back to the department, you know, it's like basically there are people reading this psychological material and what the, you know, when I hear somebody talk about like how their chief is an asshole or that would be what they say. They make dumb decisions and stuff like that. It's like, if I wrote that, then that means that the chief is going to see it. So if I write that in my report, the chief will see that. And that's not going to help the employee at all. But when I hear stuff like that, what it says to me is not that their chief is this asshole, although maybe they are. I don't know. But it's that may be a statement that comes from somebody who is struggling with a mental health issue, because there's a tendency towards like increased distress, distrust, and negative thinking and negative appraisals and making cognitive distortions. So it's like the layperson isn't going to understand that. So like making those statements, even if I'm making a case to support, some symptom, it still isn't useful. So, I'm going to cough. I have something in my throat now. So I could say just kind of what I said, like, this person is clearly struggling with symptoms of whatever. So let's say depression. So symptoms of depression. And that's evidenced by an increased suspicion or distrust of people in situations, makes judgment errors that tend towards the negative, and cognitive distortions. And I could even name like the cognitive distortion, like overgeneralizes or something. And rather than saying that this conclusion is supported by, and talking about what an asshole their chief is, I could say that, the individual has made negative judgments about other individuals. So it's like, I don't have to specifically state that, but too often that's what ends up getting put in reports, like whether it's a fit for duty or it's a report for labor and industry. And that's a problem. And this is one of the reasons why firefighters don't typically trust psychologists or therapists or psychology in general. And so I feel like I should be educating the people doing the assessment. But the thing is that this is important to know, one, for yourself, if you find yourself in a position where you've had to take time off and you do have to have a fit for duty. It's one thing if it's because of physical reasons, that doesn't necessarily impact how you think and how you perceive or judge a situation. But when there is a mental health component, that impacts how you think and how you judge a situation and how you might talk about that situation. And so I'm not saying don't be honest. I'm saying one is be aware that that's something that could happen, and that it's important to know how that information might get used. And so talking to you as firefighters is that I would say, ask about how information is used and ask if, they're going to, put things down word for word. And I've seen reports where basically they've done that. They, because it's typical to record these evaluations and then use the person's own words. But that's not considering that it could fuel the fire, so to speak. Maybe there's bad blood between the individual and the chief, and the bad blood is more about that there's a clashing personality, for instance, and less about the person's mental health issues. And so it could color the chief's response. And so that's something that definitely, you know, as an evaluator, you have to be aware of. And then, you know, if you're a chief officer and you happen to listen to my show, thanks for listening. But if you're a chief officer and you're reviewing these, you know, it's like you need to think about, it's not so much like what that opinion is that they may have of like you or the chief or whatever, but it's what that opinion represents. And so people can have an opinion of you that's not flattering. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they're, you know, mentally unfit. It means that they just don't like you. But that doesn't mean that they're not a good employee. So it's more about, you know, is there a presence of a mental health issue that affects their judgment? And that case can be made without bias, whoever's reading it. So, I mean, I think like just knowing that out there, knowing that, I mean, there are specific rules around fit for duty and laws. And I was just looking through like some of the laws and the guidelines. And it's one of the things that makes me glad I'm married to an attorney, because I could go, what does this mean? But it's important that, you know, people know that there are some very specific laws. And for the most part, usually the fit for duties are initiated because there's been something that has been observed and impacted work performance. And so, and that's a necessity. So just, you know, knowing that. I'm not sure. John, was there another question that I had? I was hoping that I would, like, questions would pop in my head because I always have questions and I get busy and it's like we never have time to really talk about them. And then now that I have your undivided attention, I'm like blank on some of my questions.
Yes. So,
hey, as an attorney, do you have questions of a psychologist around the fit for duty and a former, you know, deputy chief? I mean,
well, you know what they say is once a deputy chief, always a deputy chief, right? So
yeah.
I think that, I don't know if they say that. I just said that. So that'll be my mantra from now on. I think that
I'm the chief at home.
You are the chief at home. And I am your driver, yeah. So your chauffeur.
You're still the deputy chief.
we'll talk about that later. Anyway, I think one of the things that you mentioned earlier was that when you're brought in to do a fit for duty evaluation on a firefighter, you are actually hired by the department, and I know that you said that creates a level of sort of distrust in the from the firefighter's perspective, is that, you know, regardless of what I say, that the outcome's already sort of foreshadowed, that, you know, I'm going to get screwed over by the department, and there's this nice lady helping the department screw me over. I think that one of the I know that you said that that your job is to reassure the person who's being evaluated of the honesty and the integrity of the evaluating psychologist, which is you. And there are some, you know, like in any profession or trade, some people that are, you know, sort of dishonest and will work for the department, and regardless of what the real outcome is, that, you know, the department wants to get rid of them. And I know that there's a few cases in the country where the fire department fire chief actually sent a you know, the sort of problem child firefighter to a psychologist for a fit for duty, with the ultimate goal is to terminate him. So to determine that he's not fit for duty, he's psychologically unstable, he's not a good match for the department. And so that, you know, that was brought to, and I can't remember what the case is off the top of my head, but it was litigated where the fire chief intentionally set the firefighter up for termination in a wrongful termination scenario, using a psychologist as the sort of the instrument to validate, you know, the firefighter's unsuitableness for continuing on in the organization. I think the, you know, the other question we were talking about is, you know, when is the objectiveness? And I know that we want this to be an objective evaluation of what goes on for a psychological evaluation. And there is a certain level of subjectivity to it. And I know that, again, I'll separate out the physical, you know, the injured, the broken leg, or the, you know, the fractures, the lacerations, the head injuries, you know, the loss of a limb. Those are pretty objective. There's not a lot of subjectivity to it. Psychology, on the other hand, may have, and you can clarify this, there's always the gut feeling or the subjectivity that goes into an evaluation on an individual. Now, I know that there's written testing standards that are pretty black and white, you know, cut. But again, you mentioned earlier that some people try to shade, you know, try to game the system, I guess is a good word, that, you know, they're actually okay. And so they try to think about what you want to see as an answer, and so they'll put that answer down. And without giving away a lot of trade secrets, there's always that sort of validation aspect to it. So talk a little bit about the objectivity versus the subjectivity, because I know that we talked about that. How much subjective opinion do you have as opposed to the objective aspects of doing these fit for duty evaluations?
Well, so I think that there's a lot more subjectivity in it than what a psychologist is generally willing to admit. And so there are different types of tests that you would use. And so the idea is that you give a battery of tests, a grouping of tests, and some of them will have, I mean, and it depends on, you know, what you're doing. But if you are doing, you know, a fit for duty, you may use tests regarding, because, I mean, you basically have to establish if there's a psychological issue. It doesn't necessarily mean that you would be providing a diagnosis, but you need to support that there's a psychological issue. And so generally that means that you're establishing some sort of diagnosis. So there are different types of tests. So some are like in the moment, like they could be given repeatedly because they're basically asking about the presence of symptoms, and those are self-report measures. So and those are only as good as the person is willing to admit. So, you know, like and there are quite a few different ones, but let's say that I'm going to give a test that just asked about questions related to depression. Those you can give every 2 weeks. Sometimes people will give them to someone weekly to track, like, if they're improving or something. But those are self-report measures, and they generally don't need any interpretation. But they are dependent on a person's willingness to admit to certain symptoms. So those ones are looking at state. So it's, you know, whatever you're feeling that day when you're taking that test is to contribute to how you answer that. So it's like you could have severe depression but be in a really good place, and so you may like underreport on that measure because you're having a good day. But then the next time you take it, you could have had the worst day ever and everything went wrong, and then it's going to reflect that you had a bad day. So those are just, they're just like, they're self-reports and they're useful to help diagnose because they're just asking for a presence of symptoms. Now, the other ones that may be given, which generally are the backbone of a pre-hire or fit for duty, is the bigger, their personality assessment. So the MMPI-2 or the MMPI-3 or the MMPI-2-RF, which is a revised form, and then a PAI, which is a personality assessment inventory, and then the California one that I said. But the first two are the ones that I'm most familiar with. Those are, they are about looking at traits. So personality traits, like longer standing traits, they are not as sensitive to state. Now, they can reflect a little bit when, like, somebody's in distress. So a person who is depressed and who has struggles with alcohol problems, for instance, there are questions that are related to alcohol and coping strategies. And so it may cause a spike, an elevation on the scale that's related to alcohol. And it will do so whether you drank in the past and you haven't drank for 6 years, or your last drink was last week and you had a drinking problem. So it's looking at more the long last. There are questions there that you may answer in a more negative way or a more global way, because like the MMPI, those are, it's forced choice, so you see they're true or false. And so if you are in a negative state of mind, then you may answer something in a more negative way. So that's where it could possibly be shaped a little bit. But it is about looking at trait. So it's not typically like the other ones, like in the last month. Well, this is like throughout your whole life. But if you're in a bad state of mind for some reason, then there are going to be some things that you may answer differently than you would if you were in a good state of mind. So there can be some sensitivity to that. And the PAI, it would be similar. And that one you answer on, kind of degrees. So you get four choices, never or not present to like always. So then you have the in-between ones. So it can, you can see someone's current distress in those assessments, but it's not that prominent as far as like seeing that change a lot. Now, what does influence it a lot is not getting the person's story. So if you do not put context to these assessments, especially to these big personality assessments, then it can really give a skewed picture of the individual. And so it would be like, so I said that, one of the things, like when they design the test, is that they have questions on there that are meant to help determine if you're being honest. And so like the MMPI, it has two that are associated with lying, or so one is called it's a lie scale, and the other one is like a defensive scale. And those basically look at whether or not you are willing to admit to certain things that most people would admit to. And it's not just one question, right? So it's like there's a group of questions, and they are it's how you answer them, that pattern of answering. So I know that there's one question on there about like sneaking in to see a movie. So there are definitely some people that wouldn't do that. I actually have done it. So I had to admit to it. And I did. And I still like got the job. So, but I did feel guilty about it, but they don't let you qualify that. At least not in the test. So, but if you think about it, there's like a life scale, which is kind of a more simplistic, like I'm not going to admit to my failings kind of thing, to scale, which is, you know, I'm not being honest because I'm defending against it. And I'm, you know, it's like I'm not going to tell the whole truth. So with that in mind, it's like if Mother Teresa were alive and she took this assessment and she was answering honestly, she probably just looking at the numbers. And so basically you could take these and you can computer score them. And so you get this unbiased scoring. So it's only about how you answered. She probably would come back as invalid on the test. Because she would not admit to the things that the average person might admit to because she's Mother Teresa. So, and she didn't do those things or wouldn't do those things. So, you know, so it's important to know that, oh, okay, so you are probably the closest person to actually be living an altruistic life, which is like a whole another psychological debate about human beings and altruism. But, you know, so knowing what her life is and how how she's lived it is important to understand how some things might show up on an assessment. A Native American that, you know, does like a sweat lodge, who goes to a shaman, who has a spirit animal. There are questions there that if they answered according to their beliefs, they might come back looking like they have schizophrenia because, you know, just like how answers might look because they, you know, they believe in like that they have a spirit animal that guides them and communicates with them. They believe that their ancestors speak to them. So they believe in spirit and they may talk to them. So there's a lot that it's important to put in context. Another area where things can be skewed is someone who is experiencing harassment and discrimination or has experienced harassment and discrimination, whether it's going on now or in the past. They will answer questions in a way that it will make them look like they're paranoid and possibly, you know, like schizophrenic and, you know, I mean, so they can look really bad on these personality assessments. And the fact is that there's someone who is really struggling with a situation that has impacted them and they legitimately don't have a lot of trust. And there's a reason for that. And so it's important to know the person's story. So you can't just take the computer-generated score and interpretation and say, okay, this is good. So you need to know their story, and then you need to then understand how those, like, elevations or depressions fit in that story, like how their life story may have shaped that pattern of answering. And that's where like subjectivity comes in, because, you know, no matter how objective you want to be, you're hearing that person's story and you're filtering it through your own experiences. And I've seen this happen, is like basically like your story like triggers somebody else's story, and then that gets interpreted into the assessment. It doesn't I mean, I guess I can't say it like how much it happens, but putting things in context is important, and there can be some subjectivity there. And I think of firefighters, for psychologists, especially during the process of the fit for duty, because the fact is that my client as a psychologist is the employer, and so that distrust by the employee can affect how they answer, and then how I then apply context to it is, well, hopefully not impacted by that. But I can tell you that for me personally, I agonize a lot over, I ask myself all the time, am I being biased? Are my biases here? And mine tends towards wanting to defend and advocate for the firefighter. And so then I have to kind of walk that back and go, all right, I got to find a middle ground here. But some people, many psychologists that does this type of work, they don't have that same bias. They don't have that experience of being in the fire service. They don't understand the reality of the fire department, and that there's a lot that goes on that shouldn't be going on, but it does. And that would be, you know, like the prevalence of harassment and discrimination. And before we did this, I asked John, so what's going on in the legal world and the fire service? Like, what are the issues that keep coming up? And that's one of them. It's, you know, harassment and discrimination. And somebody that is not part of culture, they really don't understand how that can be. And so, like, someone that's been harassed and discriminated against, if they were doing an assessment, like I said, is that they might look like there's some psychopathology that would show up, like on the scale that looks at like paranoia. So somebody who has been harassed and discriminated against, and or they will almost always elevate that paranoia scale because they don't trust people, and there's a reason for that. But that doesn't mean that they're not fit to do their job. But that's how those things can sometimes show up and how they get interpreted. So if you don't believe some of the stuff that gets reported, you know, as an evaluator, then you're not going to consider that as a valid context for that elevation, and then that's going to impact how you then make your determination. So that hopefully that addressed the, you know, subjectivity. I mean, we like to say that there are tests there that are objective, and in many cases, like, you could take the computer-generated interpretation and it would be accurate. But in most cases, having the context makes a difference. But how you take that context in and use it, that's where the subjectivity is.
Well,
did that
all right.
Answer your question?
It did. Thank you.
Good. I felt like I was kind of talking around it, and I think I did start talking around it, and then I finally get to the point. So.
All right, that's good. So let's kind of wrap up.
Hopefully that was useful.
Well, it's useful for me. Because I know that, you know, we try not to live in a subjective world, to try to be more objective, especially we're, you know, applying some level of science to the, you know, to every the individual fit for duty. But again, we're humans and we have gut feelings, and it's important that we recognize what they are, and that's just who we are and where we come from.
Yeah, I mean, and when you have those gut feelings, it's important to ask questions and to inquire, like, where does that come from? I mean, as a psychologist, when I'm working with people, I mean, one of the things that makes me really good at my job is I am highly empathic. And that means, like, I feel other people's emotions. And I learned a long time ago to question that, because there are a lot of people that walk around who are very empathic and they don't know it or recognize it, and they're constantly in distress. And so it's important to ask yourself, is this me or is this them? You know, so it's like trying to distinguish between, you know, their story and your story. And that thing that I think is hard for people to do, I mean, and it comes up in all sorts of ways, and that leads to various assumptions, and a lot of times those assumptions are incorrect. And it could be as simple as, like, one word. One word can make a huge difference, and that one word will mean different things to different people.
And
it can be any one word.
A triggering word.
Well, it doesn't even have to be triggering, because it could be triggering for one person and benign for another. It could be like, good. I mean, what does good mean? We all have a general sense of it means something that's positive, but what it actually means is extremely subjective, and it would be based on your experiences. And that would differ from person to person. And it's really interesting, because people will think, well, we all speak English, so I know exactly what you're saying. But there's always, like, these nuances to the meaning that is very much dependent on the individual's experience.
All right.
Are you just, like, going, whoa?
Whoa, that's heavy. So
yeah,
and
we never know somebody, really. So
no, that's true. So let me ask the final question, there, Dr. Murphy.
Okay.
What would be some, I guess, good practices, best practices, I guess, for an organization when they're considering fit for duty for psychological? What are you looking for? I guess the first thing is, why would you trigger that sort of request? And then second part is, what would you expect the outcome to be?
Oh, boy. So, first, I would like to say that it would be nice to not need it. So best practices would be, don't need it. And I know that, and what that means is that you need to incorporate psychology into the basic culture of the fire service. There's a lot of stuff that goes on, and there are a multitude of stressors, and it's, you know, some of those stressors are from home, some of those stressors are related to the job, some of those stressors are, you know, doing the job. And basically you're asking a regular human being to become responsible for themselves, the department, and the people that they serve and the people that they work with. And that's a lot of responsibility. And so incorporating like good psychology in there can help make, you know, like a fit for duty unnecessary. You know, so it'd be like having some sort of mental health program or behavioral health program, you know, whatever you want to call it, but addressing a person's psychological. So doing, you know, like a psychological evaluation or check-in every year. So when you do your fitness evaluation every year, then you could do a psychological evaluation. And it doesn't have to be anything more than having a psychologist like sit down with the individual and just kind of talk about what's going on, you know, what are the struggles and then what are their strengths? So what's going wrong and what's going well? So, I mean, that would be one thing that would be awesome. And then support your employees in going to get psychological care, like before they need it, you know, like right now there is, because there's been such an emphasis on PTSD, it's like if you don't have PTSD, then you're not that bad and you don't need help. But the truth is that there are more people struggling with depression and anxiety than there are struggling with PTSD. And so we have to make it okay for people to get help when they're, you know, struggling with something else. I mean, even like if it's adjustment disorder, which is like in the psychology world is the most benign diagnosis that a mental health professional can give and get paid by insurance. So, I mean, at least that's how I look at it. So, you know, it's like people are constantly adjusting to what's going on in their life and at work and in their interactions with each other. And sometimes it's hard to make that adjustment. Sometimes it's hard to make that change or to cope with change or the adjustment. So having access to a psychologist or a mental health professional early on and having the support of your employer would be huge, because then the mental health as a weakness is not an issue. So, I mean, so basically it's like best practices is don't need it. But that means you have to put into place a way to support people's psychological health and well-being. So I think that the fire service, unfortunately, is a long way away from that. So since we're not there yet, then I think that the department needs to have a clear policy on when a fit for duty would be triggered, and it could be like, I'm not sure, but I mean there are basically legal rules around like when something like a fit for duty would be acceptable to request, because it is considered to be an invasive assessment. So, you know, knowing the rules and then having a clear policy on that. So if somebody is clearly struggling and they end up taking time off so that they could go have intensive therapy or something, then, you know, that is a case when they come back, they need to have a fit for duty, just like you would with a physical injury if you're off for a lengthy period of time. Or, well, let me walk that back a little bit, because I was mixing it up a little bit. So when you're off for a long period of time, you need a release from your doctor. And so there are occasions when somebody is off for mental health reasons and they are ready to come back, then they should have a doctor's note. I mean, their treating provider is the best person to say whether that person is good to go or not. And if that's the case, then a fit for duty is not required. Now, if someone wants to come back and their treating provider says, I don't think that they're ready, but this person is insistent, that could be a reason why a fit for duty would be, would come into play. So, you know, so it's knowing like when that fit for duty is needed and when it's not. The other thing is that you don't request a fit for duty from someone who is not yet ready to come back to work. And I say that because it's like that has been a situation that has come up where the person is off and it might be that they were working light duty and they were working on their mental health issues and trying to get better to come back to work. And the employer was getting impatient and was like, well, I want to do a fit for duty on them. And it's like, why? Because they're not going to pass it because they're on light duty. So there's no point in doing it. So it's like, you know, basically be clear on when you can do it. And don't do it out of, a discipline issue. And don't do it because you don't like the person and you want to get rid of them. I mean, just because you have a personality conflict with them doesn't mean that they're bad at their job. So, and if it is a purely performance issue, then don't send them for a fit for duty, because then it basically makes the psychologist party to whatever your squabble is, whatever your issue is. And then that contributes to that distrust. So if somebody is not performing well and they've like pretty much always not performed well, then and it's documented, then they don't need a fit for duty. If somebody has performed well and now they're not, then that person may need, then that may be a case where they get sent for a fit for duty because the person is in denial about, I'm struggling. But it would be much better to strongly encourage them to go get a mental health evaluation, not a fit for duty that then they're afraid for their job, but a mental health evaluation because clearly something has changed and there's something wrong, which means that you have to have a discussion. So I think that would be pretty much like why you would do them. And then it's like once you do a fit for duty, then it's like, well, what do you have in place to accommodate that person, if at all? So, you know, the person doing the evaluation can come back with, you know, they're fit, they're conditionally fit for duty, which means that they need some accommodations, and the employer is the one that decides what those accommodations are. So the the psychologist would be responsible for stating the limitations and in the impairment. So what is it that they can't do? So if somebody can't perform under pressure because it sends them into a panic, but they can, you know, if the environment is calm and they can do everything else, then you're not going to want to put that person in a position where they have to respond to emergency situations. And so, you know, then a limitation would be cannot operate or cannot make quick decisions in an emergent situation. So then the employer then decides, well, how could they accommodate that? You know, this person can't respond to an emergency, so how do you accommodate that? So so if it's conditionally, then there's going to be a need to make accommodations. And accommodations, honestly, are best decided between the employer and the individual, because the individual is going to be able to tell you more what they can and cannot do specifically over a psychologist saying what they can and cannot do. And it may change. You know, it's like when somebody has a good day, they may be able to perform more than when it's a bad day where they're performing less. So having the conversation. And then there may be like unfit due to psychological reasons. So, and basically it's an unfit yet kind of scenario. So, you know, then that person needs more treatment, which that's actually a good question. Well, I'll finish this. So, John, I'm going to ask you about unfit for psychological reasons and needs more treatment. But then the last one is unfit. It could be unfit for other reasons. And I honestly, I don't know what those other reasons would be off the top of my head. And then just unfit. But, you know, if they're going to a psychologist for a fit for duty, a lot of times it's going to be unfit for psychological reasons. And if they don't have a clear-cut diagnosis, then it's going to be unfit for other reasons. So, but we may not know what those other reasons are. So, but the unfit and needs more treatment. What is the department's obligation for that? Like, they've been off work, they've been doing treatment, they, you know, they're getting better, and they want to come back. And so you send them for a fit for duty, and the psychologist comes back with an unfit, needs more treatment. What would you do with that?
That's a great question. I think the department, you know, I'll take it from my perspective, as a chief officer, and, you know, I've never really had to face the psychological side. I've had to face the physical side, but, you know, the department has a limited obligation to ensure that all affordable treatment and care is provided to their employees. And so, I think it's imperative that the department retain a good working relationship with psychologists. So if this is a psychological issue, that there's adequate discussion between the two entities, you know, the doctor and the chief, as to how much is enough, because there's a cut point in, you know, therapy. Sometimes therapy just doesn't work. Sometimes, and it's the same on the physical side. Sometimes a surgical intervention does not work. And so, but what's that point? And again, you go to the objective side of, you know, the, you know, are you ever going to restore a limb that maybe have become amputated? Well, there's some devices that can be used. And then when the firefighter comes back, you know, can they do the essential functions of the job? The psychological component is a little bit squishy. I guess that's a horrible term, but it's a little bit, you know, I'm going to use the term squishy because I like it. It's not a solid this is the end point. This is when the person gets better. This is when they can come back to work. How much therapy, how much treatment is sufficient? And so what you would look at is sort of this, you know, the accumulation of evidence, I guess, from a, and I'll use a legal issue, is that, you know, the preponderance of evidence, how much reporting would come in from the various treating entities that would say your firefighter is fit for duty, the firefighter could come back to work, you may need, you know, a few counseling sessions every month, but by and large, they can come back. So there's a lot of discussion that goes, that has to go on in order to return, you know, these individuals to work. Some departments, excuse me, I'm coughing like you are, probably affected by the same, whatever is affecting us. Some departments just say, we're done. You know, we've spent enough time, we spent enough money, our overtime budget's blown up. We just cannot afford, you know, to spend more time trying to rehabilitate, you know, firefighter Murphy. And so we're going to let him go. And so the question, so then what happens is, all right, so now I have a disability, right? Some sort of a disability, which I'll claim. I'll file a worker comp claim because I wanted to get my disability payment. And then I'm going to sue the department for wrongful termination. So the department's kind of stuck between, again, a rock and a hard spot for these particular cases. And so if the department can show that they've done everything that is reasonable under the, you know, the current psychological evaluations, the, you know, the availability of treatment modalities, the, you know, the practitioners are, you know, are credit worthy. The firefighter has done everything possible in order to, you know, accommodate, you know, the training has showed up, has participated, all those sorts of things. And the department still sues them. There's always, or I'm sorry, the department still terminates them. Then there's the legal jeopardy, which is a whole other discussion, which I'll talk at FDIC next week or in two weeks, talking about those sort of releases from duty. There's no clean ending, I would suppose, based on this sort of, you know, it's not hard and fast. It's some subjectivity and some objectivity, but it's not clear cut.
Yeah. Well, and I, you know, I was just thinking about like kind of this, I read this like blurb earlier today, and it was about like, well, it kind of ties in with what you're saying about filing a claim. So, you know, depending on what state you're in, you may not have an option to file a claim related to a mental health issue. There are, and I can't remember, and I think it's been changing, but I know that there are, think about around half the states have a presumptive claim for PTSD, which is awesome. The problem is that that kind of leaves people who have depression, for instance, out in the cold, so to speak. And they may develop severe depression because of the long-term stress, and then they don't meet criteria for PTSD. I have noticed, and I don't know if it is related to people not using the current diagnostic code and labor and industry not being aware of that. But I've seen some firefighters who have been able to get a claim where the diagnosis was PTSD unspecified. And if it's unspecified, what that means is you just fall short of meeting the criteria. Now, that particular code, that used to be the correct code, but it's not necessarily like the DSM, but it's the ICD codes. The ICD codes had changed, so that's the international classification something. Anyway, but they had updated the code. So the code that I've seen people using that have been accepted is actually, it's the code now that is for unspecified, but it used to be the code for PTSD. So I don't know if the PTSD unspecified is like if they're accepting that, because that's one where it's like you don't meet full criteria, and that might allow people who have some of the symptoms but really have depression as a better fit, if that helps them get benefits. But the fact is that it's difficult to have a claim accepted for only a mental health reason unless your state has a presumptive clause. So, like I said, about half have PTSD presumption. And then there are some of those that actually have a presumption for mental illness. So those ones, and there's just a few of them, they will look at, like, depression, for instance, as a consequence of long-term stress exposure. And then there are states that don't have anything like that at all. And so then you would not be able to file under that. So there's that piece. And then the other piece, like what I saw, was related to long-term disability. So, does the department have or offer that? And that's the one thing I'm not exactly sure about, because applying for long-term disability is, that's a choice. So, like, people are not required to, like, get it or to apply for it. Is that's correct, right? So it's basically like this is the benefit that we'll offer you, but it's up to you whether you want it and if you ultimately use it. Is that correct? Yeah, I think John checked out.
No, I'm here. I'm sorry. I pushed the wrong button. So my response was, are you talking about the state disability or the department's long-term, short-term disability programs?
Yeah, it would be the department's long-term, short-term disability program.
Those are mandatory programs for departments, usually generated through negotiations with the labor group, but sometimes departments will do a short-term, long-term disability because the disability programs in the state are not robust enough to pay enough money while people are out on either disability long-term or short-term.
Okay. Well, yeah, and so I think that's something that I've always been a bit confused on, because the departments will have it, but the employee does not, because like it was, and I don't know if this is different, but it was that you would have to, basically you would have to pay extra, like you would have to have some money taken out of your paycheck in order to pay for having the option of, like, being able to apply for that long-term, short-term, but what you're paying, like, premium-wise, so you're basically, if you would have to sign up for it, and you would have to pay at least part of the premium.
Oh, yeah, and I think that may be – that's for all disabilities. That's just not for psychological disabilities. So I think I think the issue is, when does the – if you file a disability claim at the state level, like you said, not every state has that benefit. And so, a short-term, long-term disability plan provided by the department or your municipality or whoever is a good idea, but it's not a universal – not every department has it. I mean, of the 30,000 fire departments in the country, I would guess there are probably a quarter of them that offer that, because a lot of those are volunteer organizations.
Yeah, Well, and then, but it's like even if the department has it, the employee has to elect to and pay a portion of the premium to even take advantage of it.
Oh yeah, you're right, but I'm not sure whether it really has anything to do with our topic right now. But that's a whole other topic.
Well,
I agree.
But I mean, it is. But I mean, it's like that's an option. And so one of the things come up a lot is around like mental health issues. Is that one is their department has it, but they didn't buy into it. So obviously they're not using it. Or they can't use it because they didn't buy into it. And then the second is that they bought into it, but nobody ever suggested that they should use it while they're trying to deal with their mental health, it just blows me away. So, how could a department do better? Like, can the department have the short-term, long-term disability as part of their benefit package and they don't get to opt out of it?
I don't know. It's an individual department issue. I think it's beyond the scope of our presentation today.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think it definitely is another discussion, but that's, one way that departments can take care of their people as it relates to mental health, particularly if they don't meet like the presumption of PTSD or their state doesn't have it. But it's also a benefit that I've seen where they haven't used it. And, on the other comment, was related to you talking about how, because I asked the question, at what point can you terminate somebody? And it's like, if everything's been done and the employee's doing everything that they can do and the employer is doing everything they could do, so basically everybody's doing everything they should do, then it's like the department can say, look, we've done everything we could possibly do, and we can't do any more because obviously this person is not able to come back to work. Then at that point they can terminate. Is that correct?
Yes, unless it's challenged in court. But yes,
okay.
I'll go with premise. It is correct.
Okay, my comment really about that is that if an employee is doing everything they could possibly do, they'll get better. So then it's just a moot point. The problem comes from when a person has a mental health issue and they don't do their work. I mean, it's like nobody's going to make them better. I can't wave a magic wand. And they need to do their work, and that means that they have to admit that they have a problem and get help for it. And for a fit for duty, and you've made kind of like lame attempts at the help, like it's almost like getting help for show, but you're not really engaged in it, then you're likely going to end up in the unfit category. And so, I mean, so that was kind of the comment. It's like, if you do everything that you can do, then you will get better. And then you'll do your fit for duty and you'll get back to work. And then it's just a moot point then because you did everything and you're better. So,
right.
Hopefully this is helpful to people. I think it definitely was a little different than what we've done before. I wish that I could have remembered some of my other questions sooner. Hopefully we addressed some of the areas, and that, if if your department is using a fit per duties and they're required, hopefully you'll have a bit more confidence in it. And ultimately, I would just really like to see things evolve in a direction where a fit for duty isn't even required, because you're doing all the things up front. So rather than being focused on like intervention and mitigation, the focus shifts to prevention.
Yes.
So I think that's a good place to end.
I agree.
So I'm going to say good night and thank you. And I hope you got something out of this conversation that we had. Maybe it raises more questions, but if you have questions, you can always contact me or John even. That means you can email me at beth@integrativemhw.com. So it's Beth, my first name, B-E-T-H, @integrativemhw.com. And I focused the pronunciation. There is a V in there, integrative. It's not integrated. integrativemhw.com. So Beth@integrativemhw.com. There you go. Thank you again.
All right. Well, good night, everyone.
Good night.